Now might be a really good time for you to get angry.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
The New York Times, September 21st, 1913. The Old House at Home, a curious New York tavern. Somewhere below 14th Street is a tavern of individuality, remarked the old New Yorker. I won't locate it any more definitely, because the circle of congenial souls who frequent it would never forgive me. It would be spoiled for them if the crowd started going there. I'll say, however, that among ourselves we call it...
Nice.
The Old House at Home.
Mr. McGee! Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes. We hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Show, where we once again find ourselves not in our various little hutches located in New Jersey or Los Angeles, but instead, Dean, where are we, pal? Hold on. Take a big fat guess, ladies and gentlemen. Take a big fat guess where you think we might be sitting on this Saturday morning. It still is Saturday morning.
Yes, it is. It's still morning.
Yeah, it's still morning.
We sacrifice for our listeners. That's the thing. We decided we would wake up very early after respective Friday nights ending the week.
Yeah.
And we would wake up early and we would get to McSorley's before it opened.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take some of you who've never been here and never heard anything about McSorley's except us talking about it on a little tour of the place. We would get here early enough to be able to look at some of the memorabilia on the wall, the sawdust on the floor.
Yep.
It's hard if you haven't been here to really understand it. And one of the things about McSorley's is it's on many of these guidebooks and such, but if you try to take someone here, the frequent thing is you'll say, okay, let me take you to the oldest bar in New York to someone who comes from out of town.
Right.
And they'll say, okay, maybe I could go there for a couple of drinks and or just one and then just to see it and then we'll go somewhere else. And you can guarantee people will not end up wanting to go anywhere else.
No. It was funny this morning as we were walking down the block, Dean and I met by the Dunkin' Donuts around the corner where you kindly got me a cup of coffee. Very necessary, very helpful.
I'm Greek. It's what we do.
Exactly. Or you're Major McKinley. Look out! Dean is going to destroy me for that.
Not funny.
I've been trying to provoke one of my closest friends in the world into anger by insulting one of his heroes. What the hell is wrong with me? Sorry, pal. But we were walking down the block this morning, and there was some young couple, guy and a girl, and catch a snatch of a conversation as you're walking by, and all you hear is, it's the oldest bar in New York City. They're passing on. She didn't care, I don't think.
Well, there's that moment where the person will stop and turn around and kind of look at it and say, it doesn't look like so much, but when you walk inside, and that's what I meant about people that you bring here, they don't realize the time's passing. You end up looking at one thing on the wall and telling a story and then another thing. It's so different from any other places. There's plenty of historic bars, obviously, but this was a place that started out as a working man's bar.
Yeah.
And just the fact that a guy, 160 pounds, how long is it?
1854. Yeah.
He just loved memorabilia and saved all this. And that was not a style back then, if you think about it. Even tourism, people traveled, but the industry of tourism like it is now wasn't at all what it is. He just did this for the love of the past, the love of documenting history. And then when old John McSorley died, his son made the place a shrine to him. He came down one morning and he started nailing and screwing all the pictures to the wall.
That's why it's great. You look around here and everything. I mean, there's so many great things on the wall. If you've had a dine and dash mentality, it wouldn't work out for you. First of you'd be tackled by the time you got to the door anyway, but everything is fairly well locked down. Like these two pictures right behind you. There's some great... Well, we're sitting, by the way. If you walk into McSorley's and you go on your old internet, maybe go to your Metacrawler browser or whatever that
InfoSeq.
Is. Yeah, InfoSeq.
So when you ask Jeeves.
Yeah, when you ask Jeeves. He doesn't know. He died in his sleep. No one saw it for days. No one cared. No one noticed.
I'm Mr. French.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
He's survived by.
He survived by.
I didn't know they were together. Good for them.
Yeah, well, it was a different time. And no, it wasn't. It was, I guess it was. Well, anyway, you walk into McSorley's through the front door, and we're sitting, if you're looking from outside, and you're facing this place, we're at the table by the window to the left of the door. You can't see us there now because we're not live streaming this. Our first live show probably should be from here. Cheers, pal.
Cheers. Just crossed noon, so we don't have a problem. It's now afternoon, perfectly acceptable on a Saturday to start having some McSorley's ale.
Yeah, well, 11:58 I have, but still morning.
Well, yeah, we're taping this. See how honest we are. See how dedicated we are to getting the facts right. Even when we could possibly cover something up, we don't. There's a group right outside now taking a picture
taking
in front of McSorley's. This happens a lot.
Yep. I see the telltale shorts of the tourist. God bless him. Wait, yep. Black socks and sneakers. Guten Tag.
So let's get into some of the history of the place because we've mentioned it many times and we have a nice empty chair here. We're going to picture you, dear listener, sitting in that chair. and just give you a little bit of a tour. And we're talking the bottom floor of a red brick tenement that stood on this spot since a little probably after 1854. To their credit, Mr. Mayor owns the place. He went through his due diligence and tried to find out. They don't want to deceive anybody.
Right.
The thing about when John McSorley came from Ireland, if you look back at the records, and when he became a citizen, because you had to be here so many years to become a citizen, and they found the boat that he came on. And what they believe is maybe this is the second building that stood on this spot, because this shows up as an empty lot in 1854, but they believe another structure may have been here, because there was on some of the lots around here now that are obviously all filled up,
right?
Because the value of the land did increase between 1850 and 1855, and so there had to be something that happened, and so they believe that may have been the building, because you did have people who would say 50 years later, oh yes, this is the 50th anniversary. And again, he didn't make this place to be a tourist attraction.
No,
John.
No.
I mean, he would have no reason to lie about it.
Sure.
And so it seems like it's just something that's a little tough to document from back then. But
all right, fair enough.
Yeah, so we believe it, and it's fine if someone wanted to debunk it. I just felt that from the things I read that some people have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder rather than just really trying to document the history
right.
of it. And so what I'm looking at right now, other than Owen, I'll tear my eyes away from him, is
keep trying.
Oldest tavern in the U.S. won't allow women. And it shows McSorley's Old Ale House, forgotten by time in its fight. There's another one that says McSorley's Old Ale House, its traditions die hard, in the Boston Globe. And unfortunately, it says it's with an apostrophe, which is
wrong. That's, you want to make Dean upset? Do that.
And it says Prohibition, only the first battle. And old Bill McSorley, John McSorley, the founder's son,
right.
he just decided to ignore Prohibition, which is, it's always a great thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's like Hideki Tojo in World War II. After the U.S. dropped those two nuclear bombs, they said, well, we have to surrender now, this sword of Damocles, as Patton calls it in Harry Turtledove's alternate novel. It's hanging over us now. And Tojo said, no, we should just ignore them and keep fighting.
Yes, perhaps they'll go away.
Yeah, it seems like nuclear bombs would be a hard thing to ignore. But Prohibition also seemed like it might be. Yeah. But they do serve near beer here, and so they were able to just...
They lived openly. I mean, it wasn't like there wasn't like, you know, in your notes, like it wasn't a peephole and a password sort of deal, and you could still get in. It was just open. It probably didn't help or didn't hurt that you had a bunch of Tammany guys coming in.
Yeah, Tammany, all the cops. So they just sort of ignored it and looked the other way. And that was a big part, obviously, of Prohibition and trying to get in places. So there's some Prohibition memorabilia like that.
Yep.
And let's see, there's another thing here. Two McSorleys. It's a etching, I guess you'd call that, of Iwo Jima. And it's just some thanks from some Marines who were here for Fleet Week of 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to say 19 because who knows?
Right, because we can do an 18, and now we can do a 20.
Yeah, true.
So funny, I'm looking at something strange. Look at right above you. There's a photo, I guess, from the early 90s, and it's Dick Cheney. Looks like we need a sec def. And Colin Powell. Cheney's holding a candle.
We'll have to look it up.
Yeah, interesting.
Try to find it. And there's a bunch of pictures of JFK in here, as you may imagine. There's also bust of him behind the bar with a captain's hat on.
Yep.
And there's another picture, though, that shouldn't be overlooked. The man who paved the way for JFK in the White House as far as being a Catholic, and that's Al Smith.
Yep.
There's still a poster says Al Smith for president. Al Smith was governor of the Empire State.
Yep.
He, of course, lost the presidency to Herbert Hoover, but he did eventually get to become president of the Empire State Building Corporation that built the Empire State Building, and he said he really liked the sound of his title, which was, I always thought was an amusing thing.
Yeah. And every year there's an annual Al Smith dinner. The Cardinal of New York and all the big politicos who have something to say get together every year and, you know, put on tuxedos and, you know, crack wise and then sort of maybe put the truce flag up for a little while each year. You always see the president there. You always see whoever's running against the president there. And it's kind of a fun, interesting New York tradition, the Al Smith dinner. The party of six just walked into the back. Who knows how long they'll be holding court. But up front here, it's only a handful of folks. Some guy sitting right next to us. Table of three over there.
Watch people walk in and how they look around. It really is like a museum. And as I said, you don't expect much from the outside if you just come and take a picture.
Mm-hmm. Looking out at East 7th Street right now, it's a bit of an overcast day, and hopefully there'll be some rain, and a big Ukrainian church right across the street.
That was originally a Methodist church, by the way.
Yeah.
And it just another thing, it kind of reflects the changing nature of the neighborhood.
Right.
We talked about in the Slocum episode, we were at this very table.
Actually, we were. Yeah.
That this was originally Little Germany, and that disaster unfortunately sucked the life out of this town.
The Germans in the neighborhood moved uptown to be closer to the site of the disaster, and that's sort of where they stayed. And now it's heavy Ukrainian, and
But up, you got these. It's funny, there when you do look through the ages and through the eras here, like there's a great painting up on the wall. And that is like such great 70s New York, you know, 1970s New York.
Yeah.
It's all mixed in. It really is. It's like I've got to really walk around here with a magnifying glass someday. And you got a lot of these hip-pocketed, you know them so well. And I'm just, I keep looking at the same things. Like I love our TR vice president portrait overlooking us. It's up sort of at a 45-degree angle from the ceiling to the wall, looking down on the room, because what else is he going to do?
And that's very much the Victorian way of hanging a lot of these, too. Like, they didn't put nails in the wall.
Nope.
They would hang it. If you ever go to an old Victorian home, you'll see on a chain or on a rope. And TR did come in here. He was, of course, the New York State Assemblyman.
Yep.
And he would come in, and the guest book, unfortunately, somebody made up off of it. So, but he would have come in here. It's not a stretch. And we were talking about him being elected vice president, and that's as good a reason as any to start ticking off some of the memorabilia.
Mm-hmm.
In the back room, over the fireplace, is a picture of Peter Cooper. There's a picture of La Femme au Parroquet. That's my best French. Yeah, a woman with a parrot, and the old bartender who used to call it De Goyle and the Polly. Gustave Courbet, 1866, the print of it, an oil painting on canvas. And over that, and over the picture of Peter Cooper that he gave McSorley's as a gift, because as you do, give your favorite bar, right, a picture of yourself.
Yeah, I do that every time I go to my local, and they're really happy. I bought on a giant, standee of myself, and I said, I'm a regular, just put it in here. Can you imagine?
Well, I guess it's a little bit like...
all of you, Peter Cooper.
A little bit like if you go in any Greek restaurant in New Jersey or New York area, you'll find a picture of Ernie Anastas.
Yes.
So I guess it's a little bit like that. You know, if you're a famous person that's going there, you're going to give them a little memorabilia. And Peter Cooper, of course, the famous Cooper Union, a football throwaway, his own, put it. He came in here regularly. He sat in the back. He was a good friend of old John McSorley, and he used to sit. He had a chair fixed with a rubber seat, which I always found kind of an interesting little nod to his age, that
right.
He just sort of wanted to be able to sit for a long time and talk.
Hey,
to
you know, when you get to that age, you should have a comfortable tuchus on which to sit and a tube.
There's another chair, though. What is it? Over the icebox that says, be good or be gone, which is long McSorley's motto. So, again, this is not a place, although it is in the heart of kind of NYU and Cooper Union College now, not a place where people want to come and just get drunk and overindulge. And,
right.
I mean, it is a tourist spot, but you come a time like this, and you're going to really still experience it as it was meant to be experienced.
Absolutely. And in terms of, like, getting hammered, we talked about it in the other shows, which we've done here, our New Year's show. Yeah, I like that little New Year's show still. It's a nice little 8 minutes. But there's no booze here. It's just beer.
And that's because of old John McSorley. He said the man had never been born that needed anything stronger than an ale, which made sense because he said it early 1900s and we hadn't been born yet. And all of you nice people judging on what we're seeing on Twitter out in the world needed a little. But they did briefly experiment in the early 19 single digits with hard liquor, but it didn't last. And they decided to just stick with the ale. And again, this is why it's a great place to sit and wait. You're not going to drink one and have it go to your head.
No.
We have some friends who are maybe 100 pounds soaking wet, and she can come here and have a two or three of these and a nice conversation and not be stumbling out the door.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's funny, I'm sitting here. I'm obviously a little tired from last night. My brother Thomas and I went to Walker's, home of the longest day brunch, and had a few. Another great bar, by the way, downtown, Lower Manhattan.
Next to Ghostbusters.
Next to Ghostbusters. That's right. I've been there. Yeah, exactly. But my first set of lights are helping me bring me back to the morning and the day, and it's great to see you once again. Great to be seen. Actually,
yes.
Not too great to be seen.
But let me go back there a second. What I was saying, I realized I got off on a tangent about the back room, describing it. Again, McSorley's, the layout is a front room. It's about two-thirds the size of the back room. And you can sit in either place. There's big tables.
Yep. And it'll be communal tables.
Yeah. And so you'll sit with somebody maybe you didn't meet before. And again, we're talking to the empty chair, Clint Eastwood style here. So
that's
we're really picturing you being here with us. But I was walking out one day.
Hand up my leg, please, whoever you are. Thank you.
I was walking out of the restroom one day. I looked up over the fireplace there and the nude of the lady there with the parrot and the big picture of Peter Cooper's own self. And I saw a picture of William McKinley. And there's quite a few in here of William McKinley, which is great.
Which makes Dean very happy.
In fact, I'm looking right now at Broadway's silent tribute to McKinley.
Yep, big,
that lasted
beautiful
5 minutes. During his funeral.
Yep.
And it's just a whole bunch of people out on the street. The street cars are all stopped in the middle of the street. Everybody just paying respect. In fact, they shut off phone service in the country in 1901 for McKinley's funeral. They were just really trying to tribute to him. So I looked up and I saw a picture of William McKinley sitting in a chair with some ivy behind him and someone in the other chair. And I said, oh, is that TR or is it Garrett Hobart? And this is a really an interesting picture that we'll, of course, put up at angryhistory.com. But the original picture was when McKinley ran with Garrett Hobart, New Jersey, and Rutgers University's own. He put up a picture of himself there of the ticket because you wouldn't have seen him in those days. Then Hobart died unexpectedly. They didn't have time to get McKinley and TR together for a photo shoot. So they did sort of a 1900 version of Photoshop, and they squished TR into it. And I just thought, what a great example. This photo is probably hung here literally since McKinley was that nominee in 1896. No other reason to put it up. Nobody would care who Garrett Hobart was these days except myself and some of the people who love history at Rutgers.
A small handful of
Long Branch, New Jersey, this kind of thing. And so that's the kind of picture that you'll catch in here. And we can tick off some of the others. Also in the back room, the Big Life magazine spread during the early World War II period. Mm-hmm. You can see a lot of those pictures. Yep. The New York Daily News, August 11th, 1970. The headline, End Tomb Riots, Free Hostages.
And it was that was like the eve of, or wasn't that when the decision was?
Yeah, after the decision, because Marcia Kramer, who's a local news reporter, is in that picture.
Big Channel 2 reporter for years. Yeah. Worked with Ernie Anastas, actually, for a number of years.
Well, he worked with everyone. If you're not from New York, he's been on every channel doing something. And so he's a legend.
He gets younger. He gets younger every minute somehow.
He does. It's the Greek food.
Yeah, it is.
So houseboats win rights, liberated at last. News reporter Marcia Kramer is about to quaff a brew at the last outpost of male supremacy, McSorley's Old Ale House on East 7th. Pub opened its doors to women yesterday after 116 years of going stag.
And they weren't happy about it.
Yeah. With Marcia is Daniel O'Connell Kieran, son of the owner. Even Congress got into the act. House passed the woman's rights bill. And I like the smile on his face.
Yeah.
Daniel. It was like,
oh, Lordy.
But it was fun. You know, they really got a lot of publicity out of that.
Yeah.
I think a little bit of a nod to it. All the way to the Supreme Court again. And also we're looking at a picture, speaking of some of the other famous people who kind of come here just to be with the people that are here and soak up the history. Daniel Day-Lewis is a great picture of him sitting actually at the table right next to where we are, because Lincoln famously came here. And as we started talking about,
across the gym.
On top of that, Be Good or Be Gone, the big ice box, and the extension.
It looks like a small chair for such a big man, quite frankly. He'd be kissing his knees.
Well, he was stuck a lot of times. In fact, when he went, I believe it was to Gettysburg, they had only a tiny horse for him, and his feet were scraping the ground.
Right.
Because he was such a tall, gangly fellow, as we're used to seeing.
Look at that morning star. Look at that cudgel up there above, right next to the chair. I never noticed that before. With the spikes hanging out. It's what I'm going to go for if I need to hit somebody.
Yeah, if anyone tries to rob it, which somebody did try to do one day.
Yeah, what was that, back in the 80s, 89?
Maybe 98, maybe something 98? Like that. And
Didn't work out too well.
No, you don't want to ever rob a place where a lot of cops go.
Yeah, exactly.
He grabbed Matty Mayer, grabbed his bag for the night. I think he had 22 grand in there. He was subdued, as they say in the parlance right times, very quickly.
We come here to have some beer, of course, but you get really a good food here. And it's, basic good bar food. You get a burger, you get a bowl of chili, ham sandwich, turkey sandwich. Liverwurst sandwich is the biggie. That's what I always love to get when we come in. And Dean found this great old price list from, 1970, Dean? Is that?
About 71.
So all sandwiches, boiled ham sandwich, 70 cents. Liverwurst, 70 cents. American cheese, 70 cents. Aged cheddar, 70. Turkey, 80. And a combo of 75. And, of course, the great classic sort of food that you get here at McSorley's, cheese and crackers and onions. There's a great shot up on the wall above the clock, right next to the picture of Daniel O'Connell, a publicity shot with one of McSorley's old china mugs, Joe Mitchell's book, McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, and a plate of crackers and cheese and onions and the amazing mustard. So you can still get all this stuff. Nowadays, it'll cost you, $3 for the
cheese plate?
$3 for the cheese plate, and back in 1970.
Liederkranz cheese.
$1.10, which is, Liederkranz cheese. But the thing is, we just found out the Liverwurst sandwich, which is a favorite, they no longer have the same purveyor, the one they've had for almost 40 years. So they said
Hansel
maybe
and
expect,
Gretel.
Yeah, Hansel and Gretel. They said maybe expect to notice a difference in the taste. I'll let you know in a couple hours when I have one. But it's a great sandwich, and it's $4. Come on. Where else in New York City in particular can you get a delicious, super yummy sandwich for $4?
We're going to talk a little bit about some of the people other than Daniel Day-Lewis who came in here. Yeah. One of them, Tom Weston Jones of Copper, if you haven't seen that show.
That was a cool show. It's so funny, you know, that show lasted 2 seasons, and it was about this detective, Irish detective, in Five Points, which is, you know, I'm sure all you guys know Five Points, but for those of you who don't, it was a big notorious gang area in Lower Manhattan, pretty much in the area that is now covered by Columbus Park in Chinatown. Behind the pot-bellied stove, Tom Weston Jones, the guy from Copper, on his visit to McSorley's when he was prepping for the role, he said, quote, "The smell, the taste sticks with you when you're playing the character," end quote, which is great. I just love the fact that he came here.
Yeah,
I also love the fact that there's a show that takes place in the 1800s in my neighborhood, you know, yeah, which is awesome. That in turn, which is that awesome Revolutionary War show. Thanks. And that takes place in my neighborhood, takes place in your neighborhood, takes place, a lot of it takes place in Jersey. It's just so great that they're putting these period shows on the air. Like, The Nick is coming on. That other crazy show about medicine. That Steven Soderbergh shot, like, over on the Lower East Side. He could have done that anywhere. He decided to dress the streets again. I don't think anything has been done that ambitiously to turn back the clock with a location to shoot in that area since Godfather Part 2. It's awesome. I just remember the first time I walked into this place, and I mentioned in one of the other shows, I was 17 years old, and I looked probably about 14. And I, of course, didn't know how to order. This was back then. I mean, it was busy. It wasn't like they were in the business of serving underage people at the time. But we came here quite a bit from like 17 until, I don't know, about 21 or so, and then I didn't go for a long time, just because I was sort of out of the neighborhood and, you know, spent a lot of time in Puffy's down in Tribeca. But I always loved this place. And then once we started all coming here, you guys have been started coming here before I did again. And it's just the best place in the world. I mean, it's just so wonderful and comfortable. And for me, this time of day, early afternoon, is the best time of day. And I don't love it here at night when it's super packed, because, you know, you can't really, it's fun when it gets crowded, but not when it gets ridiculously packed and you can't have a conversation with our invisible friend here. You know what I love? There's there used to be, when you'd come in here, there would be communal pipes. So you can come in and have a beer and you'd have some pipes. And it would be like, next to the free lunch old John McSorley laid out, he kept a quart crock of tobacco and a rack of clay and corn cob pipes. And if you bought an ale, it came with a smoke, which I don't smoke anymore, but it still sounds kind of nice.
So we were talking about the food here and about it being good.
I mean, surprisingly good for, like, you don't necessarily associate really good food with McSorley's. Not that you, I guess you wouldn't, but it looks so kind of musty, and so it doesn't look like a place you're going to get a great meal, but you get a great meal.
And the other day we were in here at just kind of standing at the bar.
Just a few nights ago, talking about what we were going to do today and just hanging out, catching up a little bit.
And Brendan, one of the bartenders who knows we're in production and has an idea that we do the podcast, he sees us sitting here. He was the bartender to let us do the Slocum episode, or encourage us to here. And so he said, talk to these two guys. He told these two, turned out to be these Australians. And one of them is Sean Connery, not to be confused with Sean Connery.
No, never to be confused with Sean Connery. It means goose-stepping Nazi morons should try reading books instead of burning them.
And if you're in Australia, you may have seen some of his shows.
He's a television chef, you know, not like that Gordon Ramsay. He's not like a mean kind of, you know, allegedly. That's his persona. But Sean is, you know, he does a classier sort of thing. And he's from Yorkshire and lived down in Australia for a while, but he and his guys were wrapping up a whirlwind sort of culinary trip of America. And it was neat that Brendan threw us together, but Dean encouraged him to order up a liverwurst sandwich. Changed his life, I think.
Yeah, do you mind? Thanks.
Where were we?
We were talking about some of the different people who come in here. One of them was Chester A. Arthur.
Yeah.
And there's a life-size or full-length photo of Chester A. Arthur here in McSorley's. Where else in the world, not only the city but the world, could you find a life-size portrait of Chester A. Arthur, right?
Sure.
Arthur lived up Lexington Avenue, just off Lexington Avenue. Right. And if you map out his house in McSorley's, you could see it's a pretty straight shot, which was a good deal for Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur spent a lot of time out in saloons. Back in those days, if you were interested in politics, there was obviously no news channels, there was no talk radio, there was no blogs.
No.
Arthur was a super politico. He was just a real big Republican Party guy, and he would come here to talk politics, and frankly, he neglected his wife. And the reason he was a better president than anyone had any right to expect him to be, and he really surprised a lot of people, is his wife had passed away, and in addition to that, when he was president, he himself discovered he was dying. of what they call Bright's disease at the time.
Killed TR's mom, or first wife.
Right? Yeah, JFK had it. So this is what Arthur did. He went to really to work, and he came from saloons like this one, and he said he was going to put aside all of his old super, really partisan hack ways, and he was going to try to do civil service reform and honor the martyred James Garfield.
Yep.
Charles Guiteau jumped out, shot him twice in the back, and said, now Arthur is president, which is a bad thing to hear if you're the vice president.
Stop helping me. I don't need your help.
That'd be the only thing worse than having a president shot and being thrust into the presidency. And by the way, Arthur had never held elective office, is having the lunatic who shoots the president say he did it because he wants you to be the president.
Yeah, right.
We also mentioned James G. Blaine. He was the Secretary of State who was with Garfield when he was shot. He ends up in a lot of people's photos because he's right there at shoulder level, and his bearded visage is also one of the sharper photos in here for its age. You're talking, he was a Republican nominee in 1884 when they probably put that up. But he didn't win the presidency. He lost to Grover Cleveland, born in New Jersey. Yep. And his face is also on the wall here. His kind of walrus mustache is on the wall. Blaine and Arthur are great examples because when you walk into McSorley's, you look at these pictures and you say, who are these people? What are these artifacts? How did they get here? What's the story behind them?
Sure.
It really is a museum. You don't just come here for the ale. I mean, this place is history. It's like literally like spending an afternoon eating your lunch in a museum.
Yeah.
And so that's why we wanted to help people get an idea of what's here. For instance, there are coconuts over the bar with carved faces. They are a gift from the French painter Paul Gauguin.
Mm-hmm.
He gave those to old John McSorley, and he was able to sort of leave a permanent piece of himself on the wall here, as so many artists did. Speaking of leaving something, the urinals in the back are something you'll be visiting eventually if you're a man.
They're epic.
We mentioned that women were not admitted till 1970, but they didn't get their own bathroom until...
83? It's a long time to hold it in.
The indoor bathroom wasn't added until William Howard Taft was in the White House, so we like to call those the Taft urinals, just as we like to call that table near the window the Lennon table after John Lennon, who would sit there and write. So the men's bathroom, they say, is still unisex. It's kind of funny to sit in one of those tables, and the women, they'll walk in there and see these giant white porcelain urinals and kind of flee in alarm.
And part of the outreach to women as well, that when back in the day, when women would come in here, there was a bell behind the bar that they were just ring and ring and ring until the woman would leave. It's like, oh, welcome to McSorley's. Please leave.
That's one of the pictures Life magazine shot on New Year's Eve, 1942. It's the bartender. He's looking at his watch and he's holding the string for the bell, ready to ring it for closing time. We've been here at night when they ring that bell. It's still in use, like so many things in this place, amazingly. I remember when there wasn't even a real TV. There is a small tube TV there now. Of course, they allowed smoking back then, too, but there wasn't air conditioning back then. Owen talked about the menu. There's an item on there that's an artifact in and of itself, an ashtray. They would sell ashtrays.
All over up on eBay, I'm sure.
You could buy one and have your McSorley's ashtray at home and your McSorley's ale. Now they're not even allowed to have an ashtray in McSorley's, the bartender told us. They'll get a fine.
Hey, you know what? I'm all for that now that I don't smoke anymore. It's anything to help me not smoke and... having ashtrays and McSorley's might be a bridge too far for me.
Well, you used to walk home with your clothes smelling in.
Yes.
Nobody likes that. But having
it.
The government come in and force them to get rid of this is a bone of contention for a lot of people because this place really was a time capsule.
Speaking of bones, see what I did there? The wishbones above the bar that were put up by our doughboys shipping out during the First World War, and the idea being that let's wish you come back, you know? And they were kept there for years, and we've bitched about this before too, because it's something worthy to get angry over. Branding. That's branding, people. The Department of Health, under the Bloomberg administration, made them wipe 80-odd years of dust off of them for no good reason. You know, under the guise of just, you know, food cleanliness. If you look at it where it is in the bar, it was clearly someone who's just following orders, had to do this thing. It was dumb, it was thoughtless, and I'd say a little bit heartless as well. The dust is starting to come back a little bit, but it's just not the same. I'd like to find out which dimbulb really forced that issue. And well, remind everyone whose decision that was. Steven, why don't you do a little research? Because it's dumb. Wow, I'm actually getting really angry right now. Not just the hangover.
There's an article in the window right under where my arm is now, written by Dan Barry of the New York Times. This is a piece I had a little something to do with in that I read his article about the McSorley's wishbones. He was talking about the Iraq War, as we call it now, the Second Gulf War, as we called it at the time. And he just talked about how there was this new generation of soldiers that were being sent off for America. And he did a really moving piece about those wishbones covered in dust and why they stand there and what they came to symbolize. Except the one at the end, which someone had taken off. The bartenders used to grab your hand if you tried to reach up and touch the wishbones because they were preserved. They became a memorial here at McSorley's. And then eventually the health department came and made them clean them all off. And so I told him when they were going to make them dust off the wishbones and kind of gave him a tip, I guess. So he came here and he wrote another piece that was really great, and it's the one that's right here in the window.
Sure.
The left side, if you're looking at McSorley's from outside, you can see right. It there. It just reminds you, this place, it's a place where soldiers are welcomed and remembered and respected and not forgotten, as they are right. So many people. So many places, especially when you look at wars like the Spanish-American War that maybe we've forgotten, or the Mexican War, whether it's Fleet Week, as we mentioned, or the Fighting 69th in the Civil War, the Irish Regiment, they came back here to deal with the draft riots, and this was kind of a base for them of operations. Revolutionary War reenactors come to McSorley's. The Afghanistan War now, where soldiers are still fighting and dying. 9/11 firefighters came here, or whatever our next war is, they're welcomed here and remembered here.
It's a touchstone place.
And that's why we love history, right, everybody?
Yep, that's for sure.
So that's another little piece of McSorley's. We want to try to get in as many as we can here, right, Owen?
And there, a couple just walked in, and they're standing over by the bar right now, and I'm looking down, and right by her feet, attached to the bar, a set of handcuffs belonged to Harry Houdini. Houdini's real handcuffs, right here. And I just love that, you know, people have been putting their foot on top of them for God knows how long and would never even know.
Yeah, we should mention McGillin's Old Ale House, founded in 1860 in Philadelphia. So from McSorley's point of view, that's a new place. McSorley's has a postcard with the husband and wife, Mr. and Mrs. McGillin, who founded that place. It's on the wall over by the John Lennon table. Again, that's at the end of the bar there, between the bar and the window. That's also a new extension to the bar, by the way. That's relatively new. I mean, it's still 100 years old, right? They're also very nice people at McGillin's. They've invited us to do a podcast there, much like we're doing here.
That'll be fun to do, Eric. It's going to be great.
We'll talk about Philadelphia
history. Hop on the old Amtrak.
Yeah.
Get down there.
There are pictures, too. The McSorley's Nine, a baseball team, and the McSorley's Chowder Club. John McSorley loved to eat. He used to put a steak in a coal shovel at the end of the night and cook it in that fireplace in the back. Do you feel tough, people, today? I always want to ask. Talk about all health things we worry about. Here's a guy eating out of a coal shovel that he shoves in the fireplace. He had a club that was called the Honorable John McSorley Pickle, Beefsteak, Baseball Nine, and Chowder Club. And they would sail up to North Brother Island, which is where the Slocum, of course, ran aground. And they would have picnics up there, sing songs, just have a great old time. But the thing I wanted to mention about the Chowder Club and McSorley's Nine photos is not only did they like to drink a lot of beer and talk a lot of, what would you call it, Blarney?
Yeah, a lot of Blarney. Good amount of Blarney.
But in those photos, if you look, is the forgotten McSorley son. Peter McSorley, John's son and Bill's brother. He's also a figure lost to history. Nobody really seems to know what happened to him. Right there by John Lennon's table, near the bar, You can see Peter McSorley. He's identified in the picture, and you can pick him out.
Yep. And he's got Irish face number two. He really does, if you see him. He looks like Shane McGowan. Yeah, this is fun. This is, obviously we're having just a nice chill afternoon trying to run down some of the things here that we like about it, some of the cool things you might find up on the wall.
Another thing you might see in McSorley's is a small embroidered flag. I think that it's not far from the TR photo.
Yeah, just on the other side of it there.
But in the 1940s, it was over the taps. Because McSorley's is America, there are plenty of American flags here, so I can't really tell. But she's the only woman ever willingly admitted to McSorley's to drink. Her name was Mother Fresh Roasted. At least that's what they called her. She'd sell peanuts just out of her dress, and she would come in McSorley's. Old John would draw her a beer. His wife had died, by the way, when she was only in her 30s. So they would sit, and she would talk to him. And she's a fantastic character out of those McSorley's Wonderful Saloon series that eventually became a
Joe
book.
Mitchell.
The origin story of Mother Fresh Roasted, if she was a comic book character, would have been that her husband had been killed by a lizard bite in the Spanish-American War. Another link to the Spanish-American War is the clocks in McSorley's.
Yep.
They have never agreed, and they let them disagree, they used to say.
Baffle time. Let it be baffle time.
One of them stopped at the exact moment Admiral Dewey fired on the Spanish in Manila.
That's right.
Or at some other key moment in the battle. Every story varies. But they never
it
wound
started
the
again once Mojo graduated from Dewey.
And speaking of that war and our neighbors to the south, In the back room, there's a beautiful painting of Theodore Roosevelt on the River of Doubt. That's the post-presidency trip on the Amazon that nearly cost him his life. You can also see the huge beer pump behind the bar, but it's no longer in use. And don't miss taking a look at it. Take a picture of it or all the memorabilia above it. Just take a minute because there's just so much. I mean, there's a badge there of the 1st Cavalry Division. I mean, there's just so many things. There's a shell from the USS Texas that opened fire at Normandy on D-Day. There's a commemorative plate that marks Lindbergh's first flight across the Atlantic. There's also a huge flag over the archway in the back when you're coming back from those massive urinals. To the right side, there's a montage of a bunch of the first ladies. On the left side of that massive flag is a sketch of Irish writer Brendan Behan. He's yet another regular of note here at McSorley's, as was the late Frank McCourt, whose Angela's Ashes book cover hangs on the wall. He mentioned the urinals actually in his book Teacher Man, which I believe was his, yeah, it was his third book after Tiz. And so he was a regular here.
That's a great line from that Pogue song, Thousands Are Sailing. And in Brendan Behan's footsteps, I danced up and down the street. When he got to New York. Pardon my terrible shame.
Behan said McSorley's, quote, has been there for about 100 years and is worth a visit from anybody of any sort, size, shape, or creed. The conversation in the saloon is great on New York, which of course these old men do not appreciate now, for they remember the time when the buildings were half the size. They certainly do not appreciate the Time Life Building, nor, for that matter, the Empire State Building.
Indeed. I like that.
I guess they didn't hear about the whole, or they didn't care about the whole Al Smith being the first Catholic and president of the Empire State Building.
Right, exactly.
Also over the fireplace is a picture of General MacArthur as a young man. He could come down here from West Point on the train while studying. I like to think of him as we sit here looking at that Iwo Jima photo, talking about the Philippines in another war that he had to fight there, really too, if you consider he had to come back again. He's nearby sketches of George Washington and his generals, and together they all stare at a large mural about 9/11, also the moon landing. I can't get up to walk all the way over there, but not far, believe me. Everything, all of this is packed into a really limited area.
Yo, do you mind? Thanks.
Oh, and you can't really call McSorley's for reservations, by the way, but there is a payphone on the wall, which many of you here in the future probably think is an artifact by itself. I remember even in 2005, we had that big blackout in the East Coast, and there were people who'd never used payphones before, so that's got to make you feel old. But next to that phone is a large picture of Jack Ruby shooting Oswald, and higher above that is an old newspaper cover of a male cop dressed as a woman to catch muggers. And when you look at her, you wonder, really, muggers must be really nearsighted.
Oh, man.
But at the left of that is a plaque, and it has a brown tabby on it sitting on one of the old green beer barrels that sits in front of McSorley's. It says McSorley's Old Airhouse stenciled on it. There was always a mini at McSorley's. Old Bill loved cats. They said he reserved his kindness for animals. He had a horse. He had a goat he kept at the corner of St. Mark's Place. He used to brush the horse. He would ignore his customers and go and make sure he fed his horse and his cats. So you're going to love that about the guy. Unfortunately, the last mini left recently because the health department made them get rid of the cats. So this long string of from Bill McSorley having 18 cats when he was here sort of dwindling down from the famous John Sloan photo of McSorley's cats. It's actually called McSorley's Cats, the Ashcan School, to today. There's still the picture, but that's all that's really remaining of that part of the legacy.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much we could tick off without having this sound like a list. At a glance, there's the Treaty of Ireland, the Battle of Waterloo, the front pages when TR was shot and when Lincoln was killed. And the Lincoln is actually the New York Herald, April 15th, 1865. This was the New York Herald, by the way, which lived on in The Odd Couple. It stopped publishing in 1966, but Oscar Madison in The Odd Couple, that was the name of the paper that he worked for, by then was fictional. He was the sports writer for the New York Herald. And speaking of another martyred president, and we don't want to get too low here, but President Garfield on his deathbed, that's one of the images there. In 1901, after Czolgosz struck down McKinley, old John framed a picture of those three martyred presidents at the time, Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, put in a big oak frame, and he got a brass tag that he attached to it, on which he had engraved, they assassinated these good men,
the skulking dogs. Yep. And whenever MacArthur would leave here, he'd say, "I shall return." Everyone went, "Yeah, okay, I get it." Funny, good one. Good one, Doug. Put the pipe back. Mr. McSorley gave you that one.
That mace there that's over the icebox with the Lincoln chair.
I love that thing. That looks like something you'd see just like, you know, serious Irish gang thuggery of the day would be wielding that thing. Open somebody's head up like an overripe melon.
It's pretty cool that brickbats were a thing with the Eastman gang days of this neighborhood. They were, yeah. I think their territory ended about 2nd Avenue.
Mm-hmm. All right, good man. Thank you.
We mentioned the McSorley's Nine, the baseball team photo with Peter McSorley in 1877. So take it back just a little bit farther to the shackles hanging on the wall. The story is that those were a gift from a Civil War soldier who'd gone to the infamous Confederate prison in Andersonville, Georgia. Now, when you're dealing with the horrors of that prison, we wanted to make sure we got that right and check it out. So we asked Chris Barr, who is a park ranger at that former prison, now a museum, now a monument, if it's likely that these are really from Andersonville. And he said the practice of giving people replicas of Andersonville shackles was pretty common, so they may not be genuine. And we wanted to mention that, and we also wanted to mention that in addition to preserving the memory of those walking skeletons of the Union Army, as the prisoners were called, the Andersonville National Historic Site is also our National Prisoner of War Museum. So we'll get back to them about a bunch of things we talked about in our Alexandria episode last week about the prison that the high school there is built on, and there's the prison barges here in the Revolutionary War that were just harsh. So we want to revisit that with them and thank them for that little bit of info. And we wanted you to know we do check these things out for accuracy. We try to do that on everything.
Absolutely.
Not just tell a good story, although that has its place.
It does. You know, it's nice today. I can already feel it. I'm so wiped out from last night and having a delightful time sitting here doing this, but a mere few blocks away from this very spot, it's the Russian and Turkish baths on 8th Street, where I'm going to go and spend at least 3 hours getting all of these fine toxins out of my system and returning myself to a state of grace. Thank you to the 1892 technology that still courses through that place. We love it all old. We love it old when we can get it. As Captain America said in Winter Soldier, you know, the modern age is fine. So the internet's good. Been using that to catch up. No polio is okay. You know? So Cap had a point. But this is fun, Dean. This is a good bit of a rundown of a lot of the stuff that we have here. Obviously, just barely touching the surface.
Yeah, we enjoyed bringing you here. And I'm looking at that empty chair as the sun streams in. And that seems to be a sign. I think you're ready to go, too. I think you've had a nice belly full of liverwurst and light and dark ales. You decided you like the dark better. And so, hey, we can wrap it up here and head over to our Russian baths. We'll take our good friend the chair with us.
We should certainly do that. You had a good point, maybe doing a face-to-face here sometime. Maybe we can have a couple of our listeners come on, and we'll do a segment with one or two of them sometime here at McSorley's. Hang out and have a great afternoon.
Yep. You email us at angryhistory.com. You follow us at angryhistory on Twitter.
Yep.
You follow us on Facebook or like us on Facebook. There's been a lot of good feedback on the McSorley's episodes, and so we figured, hey, let's come here, bring you along, and have a chair for you, pull it out from the table. We love this place so much, we wanted to share it with total strangers. So.
Not for long, total strangers. Well, listen, another great time here at McSorley's. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And we'll see you next time on the Angry History Show. Cheers, pal.
In Manhattan's desert twilight, in a dead of afternoon, we stepped hand in hand on Broadway, like the first man on the moon. And a blackbird broke the silence as you whistled it so sweet. And then Brendan Behan's footsteps, I danced up and down the street. And we said goodnight to Broadway, giving it our best regards. Tipped our hats to Mr. Cohen, dear old Times Square's favorite bird. Then we raise a glass to JFK and a dozen more besides. When I got back to my empty room, I suppose I must have cried. Thousands of sailing again across the ocean, where I know opportunity, just tickets in a lottery. Postcards are mailing, the skyline skies and ocean.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.